friends, welcome back to the podcast. Some of you may know I am a big basketball fan, and that's what drew my attention to today's case. This one is so sad because ultimately greed took a person's life, and it shows how being famous and being talented and rich doesn't always bring good people into your life and won't always give you a happy ending. Lorenzen Wright had a 13-year-long career in the NBA when the unthinkable happened. But if you thought justice would be swift in this very high-profile case, you would be very wrong. Lorenzen Vern Gagne Wright was born on November 4th, 1975. Basketball was in his DNA. His father, Herb Wright, competed in Europe, and he even tried out for the Utah Jazz. Lorenzen's parents separated when he was young, but they both remained active parts of his life. When his father's basketball career didn't really pan out, he began working for the Memphis Police Department instead. Lorenzen grew up in Oxford, Mississippi, before they moved to Memphis when he was only 7 years old. It was at this time that his father was paralyzed by a gunshot to the back while he was on duty. His father had kicked some troublesome kids out of a gym, and one of them had returned with a gun and shot him. Lorenzen's father, Herb, never walked again. It was in Memphis that Lorenzen's basketball career really took off. He played his senior year of high school at Booker T. Washington High School. He then went to the University of Memphis, and he was a member of the Kappa Alpha Psi fraternity, and he was recognized as a third-team All-American in his sophomore year. Lorenzen had a megawatt smile. He had a very distinct, deep voice. He was very good-looking, and he had stacks of muscles. When he was only 16 years old, still in high school, he actually met the woman that he would go on to marry. Shara Robinson was a couple of years older than him. She was 21 at the time, so she's dating a minor, which is gross. They met each other because Shara was the daughter of Lorenzen's AAU coach, Julius Robinson. They would go on dates together. She would buy him hot wings. She would buy him iced teas, new clothes, new shoes. Meanwhile, Lorenzen kept working hard at basketball, and in the 1996 NBA draft, Lorenzen Wright, who was 6'11 and 240 pounds, was selected 7th overall by the Los Angeles Clippers. He was nicknamed the Howl because when he dunked the ball, he would always scream this loud howl afterwards. By the following year, Lorenzen had scored a season-high 32 points against the Los Angeles Lakers, but despite his personal success, the Clippers weren't doing so well. By 1999, the team needed to rebuild, and Lorenzen was traded to the Atlanta Hawks. Then on June 27, 2001, he was traded to the Memphis Grizzlies, his home team, and he became the face of the Memphis Grizzlies franchise. Meanwhile, in his personal life, Lorenzen and Shara were living the good life off the court. She was a stay-at-home mom, and he was the doting dad. They enjoyed living in mansions, owning luxury cars, buying designer clothes. They would also have 7 children together: Lorenzen Wright Jr., Sierra, Lauren, twins Shamar and Lamar, Sophia and Lawson. But the family first experienced terrible tragedy in February 2003. Shara rushed Sierra, the couple's 11-month-old daughter, to the hospital after checking on her in her crib and finding out that she wasn't breathing that morning. Doctors, unfortunately, couldn't revive the baby, and she was pronounced dead. Lorenzen, who was in Dallas for a game at the time, immediately flew back to Memphis after learning of his daughter's death. On March 3rd, the Memphis Grizzlies players and staff showed their support for Lorenzen by setting up the Sierra Simone Wright Scholarship Fund in memory of Sierra. The scholarship fund would grant an annual scholarship to a deserving Memphis high school senior who planned to attend a Memphis area college or university. Now, despite never being a superstar in the NBA, Lorenzen was a reliable big man. And even though he only spent 3 years as a Grizzly and then was later traded 2 more times, it was in Memphis where he made his biggest impact. Lorenzen really gave back to the people of the city, and to the kids especially. Everyone in Memphis was proud of his success, and he brought a lot of pride to the city when he wore the Grizzlies jersey. While he was there, he opened a sports bar and he spent a small fortune buying Grizzlies tickets for all of his friends and family. He was very generous with his wealth and he spent money all over town. He would buy homes and cars for his friends. He would pay for people to go to college, and he would even buy shoes for kids on high school teams. When the shocking news broke out of a young boy named Travis Butler, who was only 9 years old and had spent a month living with his dead mother's corpse because he was so scared he would be sent to foster care, Lorenzen heard about this and he acted. He, along with Todd Day, Penny Hardaway and Elliot Perry, provided financial assistance for the orphans' care. Another young person who Lorenzen greatly impacted was Ian Rice, who was a teenage ball boy for the Clippers. And when Lorenzen first moved to LA with his family, Ian helped him move in and he would help take care of Lorenzen's dogs and stuff like that, so they became close. Lorenzen let Ian borrow his tricked out cherry red Chevrolet Tahoe with televisions and a video game system in it for Ian's prom. And he also bought him a new tuxedo and a pair of cherry red Nikes to wear on the night. And then when Ian graduated from high school, Lorenzen and Shara went to the ceremony and even rented him a limousine. That just shows you the kind of person he was, how generous and giving he was. He didn't owe this young guy anything, but he showed up for him and he cared for him like he was one of his own. Lorenzen always wanted to elevate other people. When he spoke of his friends and family, he said, "I wanted them to share in some of my success." He was known as a good teammate, he was friendly, and he was a natural leader. By 2009, Lorenzen had played almost 800 NBA basketball games, but his basketball career was coming to an end. Physically, he was eroding now that he was 34 years old, and he wasn't able to land another contract. There were also other cracks appearing in his life. Even though he had earned $55.2 million over his 13-year-long career, Lorenzen and Shara were having very bad money problems. A bank was even trying to repossess his million-dollar home in Atlanta. They had spent a lot of money, and they had never really kept track of where it all went. Ian remembered the relationship that Lorenzen and Shara shared when he was talking to the Los Angeles Times, and he said, in his opinion, Lorenzen was in love with Shara, and she had a grip on him. Sometimes their private troubles would spill over. In August 2005, for example, the police responded to a domestic disturbance call at the Wright family's Memphis home. Shara had a cut hand and abrasions on her jaw, but despite this, there were no arrests or charges. Another time, Lorenzen and his friend Mike Gibson were hanging out in the family's RV with a couple of strippers. When Shara discovered them, Lorenzen jumped out of a window to get away from her. She forced her way into the RV. She chased away the strippers. She ripped off Mike's shirt and then tore up the interior of the RV. Their relationship had always been rocky. They had gotten married young, and they had broken up and reconciled multiple times. But by February 2010, Lorenzen had gotten a divorce from Shara once and for all. But the divorce only made money even tighter for Lorenzen. He began to fall behind paying the $26,650 in child support he owed for the six kids, as well as alimony for Shara. This figure was based on his previous income as a professional basketball player, and the benefits of a nanny and private basketball training needed to be kept up for the children. Despite his problems, Lorenzen was in talks to play basketball overseas, maybe in Israel. He was living in the suburbs of Atlanta, but he would still make regular visits to Memphis to see his kids and his friends and his family that all lived there. On the 18th of July, 2010, Lorenzen was in Memphis. He had returned to go to his sister's baby shower, and he spent time that day watching his oldest son, Lorenzen Jr., play basketball. According to Lorenzen's eldest daughter, Lauren, a few months after the divorce, her father would tell them constantly that he still wanted to remarry Shara. Lauren said, quote, he would tell us every day he was working to win her back. So it came as a massive shock to everyone on July 19th because Lorenzen went missing. As I just said, he supposedly had last been seen on the 18th at the home of his ex-wife. Now, Shara said that he had left her house in Collierville that night around midnight with some cash and some drugs on him. She suggested that he had gone out to do a drug deal, possibly. But even though Shara was the last one to see him, she didn't report Lorenzen missing. His mother, Deborah, did, which is a bit odd. So, for days now, Deborah's calls and texts to Lorenzen had gone unanswered, and she had a terrible feeling that when he was found, it wasn't going to be in a good situation. About a week into the search for Lorenzen, a dispatcher realized that a 911 call had actually been placed from Lorenzen's phone to the Germantown Police Department in the very early hours of July 19th. On the phone call, a man can be heard shouting and screaming in distress before loud gunshots are heard on the call. 11 gunshots, to be exact. The dispatcher could hear the shots, but couldn't get any information from the caller. She kept saying, hello, hello, and eventually the line just went dead. When the dispatcher tried to call back, there was no answer. We now know that this audio was the murder or execution of Lorenzen Wright. And what's really horrible is when you listen to this recording, you can hear his voice, and it's very unlike his normal deep voice. His voice is much more high-pitched and frantic sounding. It didn't sound like his usual deep southern voice at all. The problem is, it took the dispatcher 8 days to report the call to her supervisor, which really held up the police investigation. So they were, after spending 8 days looking for a missing person, when in fact they should have been searching for a body. Lorenzen's desperate cries for help went unheard and unnoticed for over a week. At the time, the dispatcher said they didn't alert patrol officers or commanders because they couldn't confirm that the call came from their jurisdiction. Once that crucial phone call had been discovered, though, investigators were able to trace the location of Lorenzen's phone to a field in a wooded area on Cali's Cutoff Road. It was a rural area off kind of the side of the road. There was lots of overgrowth and tall grass, and it was cordoned off by a barbed wire fence. It was the kind of place that only locals would know about. But Lorenzen definitely knew this area because he had bought a house nearby. 10 days after he had been reported missing, Lorenzen Wright's body was found in that field, badly decomposing in the summer heat on the 28th of July. His remains were found by police cadaver dogs, and because of the rain, the animals, and the intense heat, Lorenzen, who had been a massive, strong man during his life, was reduced to a measly skeletal 57 pounds. The coroner actually needed to use dental records to even identify him. Lorenzen had been shot twice in the head, twice in the torso, and once in the right forearm. Word of the terrible discovery spread, and hundreds of people, including his former teammates, came out to this rural part of East Memphis to line the road around the location the body had been found, to try to see something for themselves, as if it wasn't really real. When Deborah arrived at the taped-off scene, she had to be restrained from crossing it by an officer. She was so distraught. Now, obviously, the crime scene was outdoors, and the body was badly exposed for those 10 days. So there wasn't a lot to go off of at the field itself. Plus, at the time, the investigators didn't know what had been tampered with at the scene. There were 10 whole days, plenty of time for the killer to come back and remove evidence. What had been discovered at the scene, though, was part of the barbed wire fence into this area had been broken recently. They also found some of the spent bullet casings. Police determined there were two different guns used to fire between 9 and 11 bullets that killed Lorenzen. Another important finding was, at the time Lorenzen was killed, he was wearing expensive jewellery. He was wearing a gold necklace and a gold watch, and all this jewellery was found on his remains. So this shows that the murder hadn't been some kind of robbery or mugging gone wrong or like a drug deal gone wrong or something like that. This shooting was for one reason and one reason only: to deliberately end Lorenzen's life. The funeral service for Lorenzen was a huge civic event, and it was broadcast live on TV across Memphis on August 4th, 2010, from the FedEx Forum. Lorenzen's large silver coffin was beautiful, and there was a huge banner with his face on it. There were massive flower arrangements of white and red roses, and there were lines and lines of people waiting to pay their respects. Cheryl was seen wearing a short black backless dress, and she was clutching onto his coffin. She was very upset, and she was seen physically kind of supported by family members because she kind of couldn't stand by herself. Lorenzen's body was laid to rest in Calvary Cemetery in Memphis, Tennessee. The whole city mourned the death of Lorenzen Wright, and people were speculating constantly about who could have done this to him, and why would he be murdered so viciously? One of the theories floating around was that Lorenzen had gotten involved with a Mexican drug cartel and run up a drug debt and was murdered because of that. That to me sounds a bit ridiculous, because over his career, Lorenzen made $55 million, and I'm pretty sure if he owed money, he would be able to pay his debts. Part of me thinks this rumour was fueled by what Shara told the police about Lorenzen leaving the house with money and drugs on him the night before he went missing. But Lorenzen's only real connection to a Mexican drug cartel was the fact that he sold a 2008 Mercedes-Benz and a Cadillac Escalade to a guy named Bobby Cole, who was known to have connections to Craig Pettis. Craig Pettis was the one who was actually known as a drug kingpin with ties to the cartel. So it's not even clear if Lorenzen even knew who Craig Pettis was or anything about his drug trafficking. He was just selling two cars to a guy who had connections to this drug kingpin. So again, they're very weak connections. 4 months after Lorenzen's murder, the autopsy findings revealed that he had been shot twice in the head, twice in the heart, and once in his forearm. Despite the fact that the two shots to his head would have killed him instantly, the killer or killers chose to keep shooting his body more times than they even needed to. The police interviewed Shara multiple times. They were following up on numerous tips and leads, but the investigation wasn't going well. And Shara had also decided to retain a criminal defense attorney. One of these interesting tips came from Shara's neighbor, who said that only hours after the shooting happened, they noticed Shara and an unidentified man lighting a bonfire in the backyard, which seemed strange to the neighbor because it was summer in Memphis, so it was intensely hot and humid, actually one of the hottest days of the summer, so this bonfire didn't make any sense. Now, since she was Lorenzen's former spouse and the last person known to see him alive, it's pretty standard procedure for the investigators to want to question her. After the body was found, the detective spent the weekend searching Cher's home, concentrating on this backyard fire pit. When she was later interviewed by Matt Schleff for Fox Sports, he asked her very clearly, "Did you have any part in Lorenzen's murder?" You would think Cher would give a very straightforward answer, no, but Cher was outraged to even be considered as a possible suspect. She said, quote, I'm a mother, I'm a wife, I'm an author, and the police should find his killer. For my name to even be in the same sentence as something like that, I'm a minister of the Lord, and I've never been in any kind of trouble or anything. And after that long, winding answer, you'll note, she never said no. I didn't have any part in the murder. So, despite the massive interest in the case and the $21,000 reward for information, the case actually stalled out. 2 years would go by before information was given to investigators from an inmate in Mississippi State Prison. It was a guy named Jimmy Martin who was in prison for the murder of his girlfriend at the time. Now, you might be wondering, what could he know about Lorenzen Wright? Well, it turns out Jimmy was Shara's cousin. And while he was convicted for the murder of his girlfriend, Martha Jean Bones, and sentenced to 20 years, he came forward pretty quick with his account of what happened to Lorenzen, possibly trying to get some sort of a deal or get a reduction in his sentence. You know the way it goes. Jimmy said that he helped in the murder, but that the people who were responsible for the murder were Shara Wright and the guy who mowed her lawn, named Billy Ray Turner. Billy Ray Turner was a convicted felon for kidnapping and drug and gun charges. But currently he was a landscaper and a church deacon at Mount Olive Missionary Baptist Church in Collierville. This was the church that Shara went to, so they knew each other from church and they began having a secret romantic relationship. So let's talk a bit more about the motive. We know that Shara and Lorenzen had a joint debt of about $3 million. And now that Lorenzen had divorced her, he was worth much more to her dead than he was alive, because part of their divorce agreement was that he would have to set up a life insurance policy for $1 million, which was supposed to be for the support and welfare of his children in the event of his death. So, Shara recruited Billy Ray into this murder plot because they were in a relationship, and she was able to recruit Jimmy because he needed her help to pay for his legal fees. Jimmy said he and a pregnant woman he didn't know had actually been present at the house with Shara and Billy when they were actually planning the murder out. He alleged that Shara and Billy were in a sexual relationship. And get this, this wasn't even the first time the couple had tried to kill Lorenzen. No. Apparently, they had also tried to kill him in Atlanta. Billy Ray and Jimmy went to his place, climbed into the window, but they found someone else was sleeping on the couch, who obviously wasn't Lorenzen. So that plan failed, and they had to go back to the drawing board. Jimmy said he was there for the second conspiracy to murder Lorenzen, and he also helped clean up the scene after the murder. He said a few days after the murder happened, Shara picked him up and they borrowed a metal detector from his mother, and then they drove to Memphis and used the metal detector to find the other firearm which had been dropped in the field in the murder. He then went with Billy Turner to a lake in Walnut, Mississippi, to dispose of the handgun. Jimmy said after the murder, Billy had thrown the weapon into this lake. Now, this was huge information. If the investigators could actually find this gun, they would make their case against Billy Ray Turner and Shara very, very strong. But unfortunately, the search for the gun wasn't really done like the best way possible. Local non-professional divers searched the lake in Walnut, Mississippi, which was only like 45 minutes away from Lorenzen's home. They searched the lake on a day after very heavy rain, so the water was very murky, and you know, these guys weren't really professionals, so I don't know how well equipped they were, but in the end, no gun was found. The investigators believe that Jimmy Martin hadn't really been telling them the truth about the gun. And once again, the case went cold for another 4 more years. Lorenzen's dad, Herb, was a pretty quiet man. After his son's murder, he didn't really do many interviews and he chose to grieve alone. He said, quote, "It's just not something I like talking about. I lost a person that I cared more about than myself." Herb continued to live in Memphis and he continued to coach youth basketball. He has a life-size poster of Lorenzen in his house, so that way he sees him and passes by him every morning. Year after year went by, but Lorenzen's mother, Deborah, she wasn't grieving quietly. She was relentless and determined to do everything she could to keep her son's murder case alive. She had a lot of anger and energy to keep her going for the past half a decade. Her house was full of notes and news clippings, anything to do with Lorenzen's case. On the anniversary of his murder, his family and fans would gather to bring back attention to the case. Deborah would visit his grave on his birthday, on his anniversary, and when she was interviewed, she would hold up pictures of Lorenzen, or she would even wear t-shirts with his face on it. One t-shirt even had the message written across it, and it said, "The unjust, you will not prosper." She was determined not to let this case become a cold case. Deborah didn't care if she ruffled people's feathers. She would question Lorenzen's friends and acquaintances, and she didn't care if she made people uncomfortable or annoyed at the Memphis Police Department. Her son was murdered, and she wanted justice for Lorenzen, and she was going to fight for it until the day she died if she had to. At one point she said, "I'm from Mississippi. You can't piss in my face and tell me it's right." So now it's 2016. It's been 6 years since Lorenzen's murder. And I'm sure you're wondering where Shara is in all of this. Well, she wasn't in Memphis, that's for damn sure. Oh no, she dipped. As soon as she got the $1 million life insurance policy left to benefit her kids in 2012, she was gone. She bought a big new house for almost $400,000. She bought new luxury cars. She bought a Cadillac, a Mercedes, and a Lexus. She spent $7,000 on a swimming pool, and she spent $11,750 on a trip to New York. She bought lots of new clothes. She spent $70,000 on furniture. She went on a spree. And, you know, how was she affording all of this? Because the money was supposed to be used for the care of the couple's children. It wasn't for her own use. But because she was the policy's administrator on behalf of her children, Shara was able to blow it all in a couple of months. Most of the entire insurance payout was gone in 10 months. She was still living like she was married to an NBA basketball player, but she wasn't. She was also in a new relationship. She actually got remarried to a local sheriff's deputy named Reginald Robinson, and she was now going by the name Shara Wright Robinson. Oh, and she also became an ordained minister. Her ministry was called Born to Prosper, which is a little ironic in my opinion. So, because of the way Shara was using or misusing the insurance money, Herb Wright, Lorenzen's dad, who was also the executor of his will, launched a legal battle against her to try and oversee his grandchildren's inheritance. It was a very messy situation, and both sides accused each other of financial mismanagement. When Shara wasn't busy blowing through money, she was busy writing a book titled Mr. Tell Me Anything, where she described a fictionalized version of her life as an NBA wife, and how her husband broke her down, how he cheated on her, and how he abused her. It made Lorenzen look like a really bad guy. Some people believed the stories of violence, and some didn't. Lorenzen's mother wondered if this was the case, why did Shara stay with him for so long, when she could have divorced him at any stage and gotten plenty of money in a settlement? I know things aren't always that simple in a marriage, but Deborah does have a point. And when Deborah heard of Shara's literary masterpiece, she said, quote, "This is the book I want to read. How I Orchestrated Getting My Ex-Husband Killed." So we know what her opinion is. Now, I'm not sure what happened between Shara and her new husband, Reginald, but by 2015, she had moved to Houston, Texas with her kids and her new boyfriend named Kelvin Cowens. He was actually a journalist who met Shara when he was writing a story for a weekly newspaper marking the fifth anniversary of Lorenzen's death. They had a six-hour discussion together and soon started dating within a week or two. Shara divorced Reginald Robinson only a few months later. Even now, she was still living lavishly. She would keep spending. She bought a grey Jaguar, she bought a BMW, she spent $15,000 at Christmas. Even after all the insurance money was gone, she still had some property and assets of value from her first marriage. She had mink coats, she had Rolex watches, and an estimated 300 pairs of shoes. Shara broke up with Kevin Cowens in February of 2017. Now, at the same time, Lieutenant Darren Goods was running the Memphis Gang Task Force, and up until now, he hadn't really had a lot to do with the Lorenzen Wright case. But he was approached by a deputy sheriff, who said that he had been approached by someone with information about who was possibly responsible. So they held a secret meeting about this information, about the validity of this source, and Lieutenant Goods felt like they were finally onto something. The task force was named Operation Rebound. Lorenzen was known for his ability to rebound the ball, and the whole point of rebounding the ball is that it gives you an opportunity to quickly score again. So it was a really good name. I'm just going to say that. I thought it was cool. Paul Hagerman, who was the prosecutor at the time, suggested that they reinvestigate the lake where the gun was supposedly dumped. The difference now was they actually had FBI resources to search the lake properly. They were able to activate a real dive team this time. They even set up a communication center on land on the side of the lake. And would you believe the divers only took like 40 minutes in the water before one of the divers shouted, "We've got it!" Now, all the detectives were in shock. They literally couldn't believe that it had been so quick and easy to find this gun the whole time. The diver got out of the water holding a Tupperware box filled with water and a 9mm pistol. The mood was obviously ecstatic. Everyone was giving each other high fives and hugging because this was a major break in this case. Now, to be sure that this was the actual murder weapon, they compared the shell casings found at the murder scene to ones fired from the gun in the lake, and they were a perfect match for each other. So now that they had the murder weapon, they had a much stronger reason to believe what Jimmy Martin actually said was true. So once again, Jimmy was interviewed about his account of the murder of Lorenzen. He said Shara lured Lorenzen out to this field and that Billy Ray and Shara were waiting there for him, and when they spotted him, they started shooting him. The problem was Lorenzen started running and ducking, trying to avoid them, and he even jumped a fence while he called 911, which is why on the recording he could be heard shouting in panic as the shots were fired at him. And you remember, they also found like a broken piece of barbed wire fence at the scene. Jimmy said, quote, "He got shot a couple of times and then he fell down." The detectives believe the field where Lorenzen was murdered was actually well known to Lorenzen and Shara. They thought that they used to hook up there kind of as a kind of a lover's lane or whatever. So it was pretty easy for her to convince him to meet her there. Investigators found a series of explicit texts that Shara had sent to Lorenzen on July 17th, right before the murder. She knew that Lorenzen wanted to rekindle their relationship, and Sherry used the promise of sex to manipulate Lorenzen to travel from Atlanta to Memphis. Literally, he got on a flight the next day without even packing clothes, just so he could meet her. There was never a drug deal gone wrong. She had just said that to police to throw the suspicion away from herself. Now the investigators had proof. They had a load of sexually explicit text messages between Shara and Lorenzen that she was luring him to that specific place that night. And her phone records proved that she was actually there when Lorenzen was murdered. Now we know Shara is a manipulator. She was manipulating Billy with sex, and she was manipulating Lorenzen with sex. And mainly, she just couldn't bear the thought of giving up that luxury lifestyle that she had gotten used to when she was married to a successful athlete. Now, the detectives working on Operation Rebound chose to keep the discovery of the gun, this massive, massive news, very close to the chest. They didn't want word of this key evidence getting out and spooking anybody into doing something rash. They chose to bide their time until they had established a wiretap on Shara and Billy's phones, so that when the news broke in the media, the team would be able to intercept any calls and messages between the two, and they were able to see what these two were saying to each other about the news of the gun. When the news of the gun became public, it was, you know, all over the place. And just like clockwork, Shara suddenly started calling Billy. Two people who hadn't talked to each other in a very, very long time, who live in two different states, now suddenly, with a murder weapon being found, are all talk. Can you imagine how frantic her ass was? She'd spent 6 years thinking she got away with murder, spending all of Lorenzen's money, living the high life, thinking that this was a cold case that no one would ever solve. Well, now this happened, she jumped on the first flight back to Memphis. I hope she was sweating the whole way. Operation Rebound was running surveillance on her as soon as she landed off the plane. She was actually under 24/7 surveillance now, and so was Billy Ray Turner. So when Shara landed in Memphis, she and Billy were planning to meet up with each other and have Sunday dinner. Obviously, because they were being wiretapped, the cops knew all about this plan, so they had a surveillance team waiting outside the house to take pictures of the whole meetup. Now, instead of going into the house and talking, these two decided to walk up and down the street together for about 30 minutes, and they were talking non-stop. Billy was looking around, making sure that no one was watching them too closely, and officers could see that Shara was getting very, very worked up. Now, this moment was significant to the investigators because even though they weren't able to, like, hear exactly what they were saying, this was the first time that they had been able to link the two of them together physically in person. Now, remember, earlier when Jimmy mentioned that he wasn't the only person that had witnessed Shara and Billy plan the murder. He said that there was a pregnant lady who he didn't know also at the house at the time. He said that this girl was there a lot. So the investigators decided to track down who this woman could be. It turns out it was another one of Shara's cousins, a woman named Claudia Robinson. Claudia was a school teacher with no criminal records, so her testimony about this was going to be very vital to the prosecution. She admitted that she had been at the house on two separate occasions, and Shara was talking about killing Lorenzen with Billy. When I heard this, I was thinking to myself, like, Claudia, you're a smart person. Why didn't you say anything before now? We don't know her reasons. The next big nail in the coffin for these two idiots was Shara wasn't the only person who brought her phone to to the field when Lorenzen was murdered. Billy had also brought his cell phone when they shot Lorenzen, so the investigators were able to check cell phone tower data and prove that his cell phone was also pinging off of towers right where the murder happened. Now we're in 2017, and things are really getting eventful. Shara had moved again. This time she relocated to Riverside, California, and she'd met a new man. She'd married a guy named Tim Robertson, who was working for a record label. The police were still currently surveying Billy, following him around, and he was actually at a gas station at the front register, paying at the counter when he was arrested on first-degree murder charges on December 5th, 2017. You can actually see the arrest on surveillance footage. And for just a split second, his face looks very confused when his hands are being pulled behind his back to be handcuffed. I'm sure after 7 years, he was shocked to finally be arrested. When he was being questioned by the police, they started hitting Billy Ray with some serious questions. And at first, he tried to lie his way out of things, and then he just panicked and terminated the whole interview. With the news of Billy Ray's arrest, everyone was wondering when were they going to arrest Shara. Well, the detectives chose to let Shara go back to Riverside, California, in the hopes of her incriminating herself further. And sure enough, she did. As soon as she got home, she started Googling, how long do fingerprints last on a gun? And how long do fingerprints last on a gun underwater? She was scrambling. Only 10 days later, on December 15th, Shara Wright was finally arrested for the murder of Lorenzen Wright and extradited back to Memphis. But of course, she pleaded not guilty. When Shara appeared in Shelby County courtroom in her orange jumpsuit, Deborah shouted at her, "How could you do this to my son?" Tennessee prosecutors alleged Shara recruited her cousin Jimmy Martin and Billy Ray Turner, who she was having a relationship with, to assassinate Lorenzen Wright. Now, Deborah was thrilled at the news, and she was even glad that it had taken them so long to arrest Billy Ray and Shara, because in her mind that meant the detectives had gotten enough damning concrete evidence against the pair of them that way they would be put behind bars permanently. There was going to be no loopholes, no, you know, overturned things, you know, they were going to get put down. The defense team were planning on putting forth evidence that Shara was in fear of Lorenzen, that he would regularly beat her, that he would beat the children, that she thought he would never leave her alone, and that she was suffering from battered woman syndrome. But Shara was warned by her lawyers that if she was found guilty, she would have to serve life in prison under Tennessee law with a minimum of 55 years. Now, clearly Shara thought this was too much of a risk, so she panicked and she decided to take a plea deal, which made everyone, including Lorenzen's family and the investigators, very upset. On July 25th, 2019, Shara Wright pleaded guilty to the facilitation of the first-degree murder in the shooting of Lorenzen Wright. The judge said, quote, "Miss Wright, it is the judgment of this court that you are guilty. This court sets your punishment at 30 years confinement in the Tennessee Department of Corrections." After this, Deborah spoke directly to her former daughter-in-law in front of the court. She spoke about her 6 grandchildren, saying, quote, "We still love them. That is all I want. I want my grandkids. That's it. I just hate what happened to my child. But he left some nice-looking kids there for his grandma. They want to see me. I want to see them." Shara looked at the judge, and she asked, "Am I able to respond to her?" But the judge asked her defense lawyer, Junie Ganguly, if she wanted her client to say anything. Ganguly said, "No, Miss Wright has nothing to say at this time." The The issue is, with this plea arrangement, Shara only has to serve one third of that sentence, and she's eligible to try for parole, which no one is happy with. Deborah obviously wants Shara to serve the full 30 years because, in her words, her son is serving a life sentence. Very sadly, though, Shara's children still stand by her completely, and they don't believe their mother had any part in their father's murder. I think Shara got off too lightly. But anyway, now Shara's been dealt with. If you're wondering what happened with Jimmy Martin, well, he was granted immunity in Lorenzen's murder because he gave the prosecutors his testimony, and he also told them where to find the murder weapon, which was crucial. Plus, he was already in prison for his girlfriend's murder, so he was locked up anyway. Now it was time to get Billy Ray. The trial against Billy Ray Turner started in March 2022. It took a while to get going because of COVID delays. And Billy Ray had already pleaded guilty to possessing a weapon as a convicted felon after two guns were found in his possession when he was arrested in 2017. So he was already serving a 16-year sentence on that gun charge. But despite this, and even after everything that happened at Shara's trial, Billy Ray chose to plead not guilty in the murder case. His defense attorney, John Keith Perry, claimed that Jimmy Martin's testimony was complete nonsense and it was all lies. He tried to say that Billy Ray, who was now 51, was a good church-going man, he was a business owner, and he served jail time as a young man for those felony convictions, but he wasn't that person anymore. Perry said that it was Jimmy, and Jimmy alone, who was responsible for murdering Lorenzen in the field. That Jimmy wanted to get paid by Shara, so he was the hitman, not Billy Ray. Perry said Jimmy Martin was, quote, the type of person who changes facts like a person changes their drawers. The prosecutor, Paul Hagerman, was able to defend Jimmy's testimony, though, because Jimmy literally had no reason to lie to them. Jimmy's whole immunity was based on the fact that he told the complete truth, and that all of his statements to the police had to be completely consistent, or else he would also be charged. Hagerman said Jimmy's account had literally been the same for the past 10 years. The prosecutors also alleged that at a meeting at her house, Shara told Billy Ray that Lorenzen actually had a hit out on her. So Billy Ray believed her at the time, and he obviously cared about her, so he went and took Lorenzen out first. Apparently after she told him about this threat on her life, Billy Ray said to her, "What do you want me to do, Shara?" And that's when the murder conspiracy began between the couple. During the trial, the jury heard the chilling 911 call made by Lorenzen Wright as he was being murdered. They heard the sound of multiple guns firing at the same time. It was very clear that there were two shooters at this scene. No one believed that there was only one shooter. Jimmy Martin testified that it was Shara and Billy Ray who were the two shooters, and he helped them clean up the evidence in the days after. Paul Hagerman told the jury, "It took an evil heart to do this." Throughout the trial, things between Judge Lee Coffey and Mr. Perry, the defense lawyer, got a bit contentious. A lot of times when Perry would make an objection and Judge Coffey would rule on it, they would get into arguments about the ruling. Judge Coffey felt Perry was being disrespectful to the court, and he made that point to the jury before they went in to deliberate. Perry believed that the judge was sending signals of bias to the jury, saying that the judge tried to paint him as being unprofessional. Perry believed that Billy Ray deserved a retrial because of all of this. The prosecution denied these allegations. Hagerman said, quote, "Mr. Turner had a fair trial that Your Honor presided over without bias and in accordance with the law." After the closing arguments, the 12-person jury deliberated for about 2 hours before they found Billy Ray Turner guilty on all charges. Guilty of first-degree murder, attempted murder, and conspiracy in the death of Lorenzen Wright. Judge Coffey sentenced Billy Ray to a life in prison for the murder conviction. On July 8th, 2022, Billy Ray Turner was sentenced to life plus 41 years. The judge decided that he will serve it concurrently, and he also detailed how Billy Ray had a history of racking up 12 felony convictions over 25 years, and even though he did manage to stay out of trouble at times, he was a continuous dangerous offender who stood over Lorenzen Wright and shot him 9 times, even though the 2 shots were fatal. Cheryl Wright Robinson is currently serving her sentence at the Deborah K. Johnson Rehabilitation Center. She has had 50 reported incidents between 2018 and 2019 where she's been reprimanded in minor and major incidents. One time she flooded her cell while she was in there naked, and even after a mental evaluation was done, she was found competent, sane and non-committable. Cher's first opportunity at parole will be in May 2027. Lorenzen was only 34 years old when he died. He left behind so many people who loved him, including his friends and teammates, and most terribly, his 6 children and his mother. Finally, after waiting 12 years, both of his murderers are behind bars, and his mother Deborah can finally close her eyes at night and get some peace. Hope you guys enjoyed today's episode. Let me know what you guys think on Instagram. Check out on Spotify or Apple Podcasts, wherever you listen. And I would really appreciate a good rating. Thanks, guys. If you'd like to see any of the interesting images I found while researching this case, please follow along to my Instagram account at Dark Emerald Podcast. Feel free to like, share, send me a message. I'd love to hear your thoughts on the case. Bye.